I'm going to talk to you tonight about humans to Mars, how we can get humans to Mars within a decade, either a decade from now or a decade from when anybody finally turns on the money. And I will talk a little bit about why I believe the problem has to be approached in that kind of way. I'm going to spend some time talking about how the mission can be done. I'm going to spend a bit of time talking about why I think this is something important for humanity to do. And I'm also spend a little bit of time talking about what we can do, what you can do to make this happen. Now, of course, in the course of a talk of this length, one cannot really adequately handle any of those subjects, let alone all of them. But fortunately, I've written a book on the subject called The Case for Mars. They happen to have a box of them here. After the talk, you want to get one, you buy them, I'll sign them. It's a win-win situation. And they're just $20 Australian, which, as you know, is nothing. There you go. So, humans to Mars, within a decade. Well, before we talk about how to get humans to Mars, how humans can explore Mars, I want to spend a few minutes talking about how humans have explored on the Earth. Because I believe that it's only by looking at how humans have successfully explored the Earth that we can develop intelligent plans for how humans can explore other worlds. So, this is a photograph of one of the great ships in the history of human exploration of the Earth. Now, she doesn't look like anything that you might call a great ship. I think we need to turn off some other microphone here, like that one. Okay? She doesn't look like a great ship. She's not very big. Look at her. It's not that great a picture, but just look at the two people standing next to her over here. If you cut off her mast and bowsprit, you could put this ship inside the space shuttle payload bay, the entire ship. And yet she is one of the great ships of human history. She's the Yoa. She's the ship that Captain Amundsen used to do the first successful Northwest Passage. Now, in many respects, this mission was a lot like the first human mission to Mars. Okay, the duration was 3 years, which is about what the first round trip to Mars is going to take. The size of the crew was 6 people, not 60, not 600, but 6 people, which is about what we're going to have on the first human mission to Mars. And for 2 long Arctic winters, the crew had to live below decks on the Yoa, within living quarters that are actually smaller than those on the space shuttle, let alone those on any trans-Mars habitat that I or anybody at NASA has ever seriously proposed. So in terms of all the human factors challenges associated with the Mars mission, duration, isolation, social space, physical space, they took them all on and passed with flying colors. And that's of some interest, because there's a bunch of people running around right now that say that the human psyche is going to be the weak link in the chain of the piloted Mars mission. I don't believe that's true. If you compare the piloted Mars mission to previous stressful things that people have done, previous generations of explorers, or other tough stuff, such as soldiers in combat, prisoners in prisons, refugees in hiding, you find that the human factors challenge of the piloted Mars mission is comparatively modest. And far from being the weak link in the chain of the piloted Mars mission, the human psyche is likely to be the strongest link in the chain. Well, that's all well and good, but what's so important about all this? Well, the thing that's really interesting about this is that while this was the first successful Northwest Passage, it was by no means the first attempt. In fact, there had been over 100 previous attempts, and they all failed. And the interesting thing is that of those 100 previous attempts, every single one of them was done on a scale at least 10 times bigger than the Amundsen expedition, and in some cases 100 times bigger, okay, in any measure of mission heft that you might care to define, such as tonnage of the vessel, size of the crews, the amount of money behind the mission, the number of people involved in planning the mission. They were all at least 10 times bigger than Amundsen's, and every one of them failed. In the 19th century alone, The British Navy alone tried 30 times to do the Northwest Passage and failed every time. Okay? And these were not trivial affairs. These, you know, they didn't go into the Arctic with an old sealing boat like Amundsen. No, they went with fleets of steam-powered warships supported by convoys of supply vessels, missions planned years in advance by the largest and most serious planning bureaucracy in the world at that time, the British Admiralty. And they failed every time. Okay? They'd steam into the Arctic, breaking ice, until eventually they'd get frozen in. And then they'd try to winter over, and they would winter over, and they would do that, and they'd eat their way into their supplies that they had brought along, generally several hundred tons of salt pork. And then finally in the spring, they'd generally be able to break out, and they'd make some more progress, and then eventually get frozen in again, and then repeat the process for 2 winters, 3 winters, in one case, actually 5 winters. But eventually the supplies had run out, and they'd have to turn around and make for home. And in most cases, they actually did make it home. But in no case did they actually do the Northwest Passage. Now, Amundsen was frozen in for 2 years on King William Island, which is the island in the Canadian Arctic, in the exact same place, virtually the exact same place, that Sir John Franklin and his 2 steam frigates and 127 men were frozen in on 1847. Now, the Franklin expedition perished to the man. They ate their way through their 300 tons of salt pork, and then they had no food left, and they were still frozen in it, so they tried to escape to the south, but they couldn't do it, and they had no mobility, and they dropped in their tracks, man-hauling sledges filled with their valuable possessions. And many of you may, in fact, recall that in the 1980s, Franklin's men were finally dug out of the ice, together with several crates of very fine Victorian china, I might add. The Amundsen expedition, the Amundsen expedition was frozen in the same place, for a longer period of time than it took the Franklin expedition to disintegrate. But he and his men did not starve to death on King William Island. No, they got fat. They gained weight. They got fat eating caribou, which abound in the area. Because the Amundsen expedition did not go into the Arctic with 300 tons of salt pork. The little Yoa couldn't have carried it, and he couldn't have afforded it. His expedition was done on private money. It had to be what you might call a pork-free mission. Okay. Rather, what Amundsen did was they went into the Arctic with half a dozen hunting rifles and men who knew how to use them. And they brought something else. They brought dogs and dog sleds and men who knew how to use them, which is an art in itself. And the dog sleds are essential to give you the mobility to hunt the very mobile herds of caribou. And what this combination allowed Amundsen to do was survive by living off the land. And not only survive, but explore. Okay? See, the Amundsen expedition, in the 2 Arctic summers they were frozen on King William, they didn't spend their time sitting on the deck of the Yoa staring at the ice, praying for it to break up. No, they spent their Arctic summers roaming hundreds of miles overland, traveling this way and that by dog sled. Hunting, yes, but also exploring. And in consequence, they discovered that the Earth's magnetic poles move. That it is an important discovery in geophysics, and it was made by Amundsen, and it was only possible to be made by Amundsen because of this extremely potent travel light and live off the land approach to exploration that he took. So the moral of the story is that if you look at the history of human exploration of the Earth, it has been shown repeatedly, in fact, that it is possible for a small group of people operating on a shoestring budget to succeed brilliantly in carrying out a program of exploration when numerous others with vastly greater resources behind them had repeatedly failed, provided that the small group makes intelligent use of the resources that are available in the environment they intend to operate in. That's the Amundsen story, that's the Lewis and Clark story, that's the story of dozens of exploration programs that one could go through. So how does this relate to Mars? Well, let's move forward in time a bit. To 1989. President George Bush gets up on the steps of the National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., flanked by Armstrong and Aldrin and Collins, the Apollo 11 crew. And he says, this is the 20th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. That was great. That's what America is all about. And therefore, I, as president, am committing us to go back to the moon and on to Mars, and this time to stay. Great stuff. So he started this program that became known as the Space Exploration Initiative. Well, what happened next? NASA, Space Agency, went off to conduct a study on how this might be accomplished. And they came back 3 months later with a report, which was called the 90-Day Report, in which they said, George, we can do it. We can get you to Mars. We will need 30 years to prepare, and we will need a budget of $450 billion. But if you can give us that, we are ready to rock. And this is the sort of thing they proposed. This here is design for an interplanetary spaceship. I call it the Death Star. It's 100 meters long. It's as big as a football field. It weighs 1,000 tons, which for comparison is about the payload the United States has launched to orbit cumulatively since 1975. Okay? It has one, two, three, four, five big tanks of liquid hydrogen here, each weighing 150 tons. So each of these would have to be launched to orbit separately by a launch vehicle with the capability of a Saturn V moon rocket. That would take about a year, during which time most of the hydrogen would boil away. But we'll put that problem aside, because there are others, such as the need for two nuclear rocket engines here, which do not exist, each with 75,000 pounds of thrust, so that this truss here, which would have to be built in space, would have to take a load on it equivalent to a truss standing vertically on the surface of the Earth with 75 cars stacked on top of it. And then here you have the payload. It's kind of complicated. Let's not even talk about it, except to notice that it is behind an aeroshell, about 35 meters in diameter. So that aeroshell is much too big to fit inside the fairing of any launch vehicle that anybody is willing to build. So this would have to be constructed on orbit with all the structural integrity required of an aeroshell that's going to need to hit Mars at Mach 30. Okay? And indeed, the entire Death Star would have to be constructed on orbit, because if you tried to launch this in one piece, you know, you'd blow away Orlando when you took off, which would be bad for morale at the Cape. And so they came up with a plan to build the Death Star on orbit. You can build a Death Star on orbit in 10 easy steps, provided that you have available to you on orbit orbiting hangars and cryogenic fuel depots and power generation stations and construction docks and checkout points and crew construction shacks, and an entire array of orbiting paraphernalia that collectively I call the parallel universe. And that was the plan. Spend 30 years and $400 billion to build a parallel universe within which one can build Death Star spaceships and sail them off to Mars. Well, a lot of people in the aerospace industry knew what was going to be in the 90-day report before it came out. And at the Martin Marietta Company, which is where I was working at that time, we certainly did. And what happened there was a bunch of us engineers went to management and we said, look, this is not going to work. We could give you a whole bunch of technical reasons why this won't work, but you wouldn't understand that. Actually, as I recall, we left that part out of the briefing. Okay. But you can certainly understand that nobody is going to give them $400 billion in 30 years in order to do this. Well, you know, those of you who know something about this probably know that the upper management of the American aerospace industry is composed exclusively of brilliant visionaries with lightning-quick minds. So they said, let's wait and see. So they waited and they saw, and the 90-day report went down like a lead balloon in Congress. And so what happened at that point, though, was interesting. They came back to us. They actually came back to us, and they said, okay, so what do you want to do since you're so smart? Okay. And what we said was, look, what we want to do is we want to form our own team of engineers with a clean sheet of paper charged with coming up with a more practical plan for doing human Mars exploration. And here's the deal. We don't want to have a bunch of managers or marketeers or people like this coming in here and telling us we got to design the mission this way or that way because we know some guy down at the Johnson Space Center or the Marshall Space Flight Center or Jet Propulsion Lab or one of these places who's pushing this technology or that technology and really wants to see it included in the mission plan. Okay? You see, because it is that kind of thinking that had driven the 90-day report so berserk. It is not true that the people who designed this mission plan were stupid. Okay? Individually, the vast majority of engineers involved in this mission plan design were extremely competent and intelligent people. It's just that collectively, they were a nuthouse because what they ended up doing was designing the most complicated mission they possibly could in order to make everyone's pet technology mission critical. And that is the exact opposite of the correct way to do systems engineering. And it was going to be hard enough to come up with an attractive human Mars mission plan without being driven by such imperatives. And because the situation was basically hopeless otherwise, management said, yes, you're on. Do what you can. And so we formed a team of 12 people from the whole huge Martin company, and I was one of them, and charged with coming up with an alternative plan. And because there were a lot of creative spirits on this team, we could not agree with each other. So we actually ended up designing 3 different plans. And management, to their credit, did not try to reconcile these plans into a company party line. Instead, they said, well, let's just present them all, see which flowers bloom. And we did. And it rapidly became clear that one of these 3 plans, known as the Mars Direct Plan, which I was largely responsible for, along with another fellow named David Baker, that this plan had the most potential for overthrowing the situation. It was the most radical departure with this kind of thinking, in that it involved no orbital infrastructure, in fact, no on-orbit assembly, in fact, no orbital rendezvous of any kind, and no advanced propulsion. And in fact, looked at in the spring of 1990, you could say this was a shot for humans to Mars by 1999. And because of that, it immediately became extremely controversial because we really had thrown down the gauntlet. And it became very controversial. There were a lot of people both within NASA and the aerospace industry, including even Martin's competitors, that became very enthusiastic for it immediately. There was also intense opposition, very heated and intense opposition. Thank you.